All right. Well, thanks a lot for having me. I've been having a lot of fun this far. Also with the jam sessions we had earlier and all the talks have been great. So I guess my talk might be somewhat similar to what Matthias has been talking about yesterday, like just little things that actually make the platform. And that's also what I do as a, well, I was going to say for a living, but I'm actually unemployed at the moment. I've been working 7 years for Opera Software, and I decided I wanted a change. And I haven't quite figured out what the change is, but I've been unemployed since August 1, and I'm trying to figure it out. So yeah, first I wanted to pitch a thing. A friend of mine who works at Apple now and worked at the W3C before, he had this goal, and he had it quite a while back. He posted this in March or so, or May, I don't remember. But then my register sent me this email that they had these new top-level domains available, and you could have TF. And I sort of recall, like, what can you make with TF? Of course, you can make WTF, but they don't do a single letter. And then I recall, oh, Dean had that thing. So I registered this domain, and if you can all go there and you can retweet his tweet. That's pretty much the only purpose for it now. I kind of like just setting up domains. They're pretty cheap to get, and yeah, you can do fun things with them. But that kind of brings me to the next thing. Like, I made sure this exists as well. So if you go here, you get something. But the main point is to discuss URLs a little bit. The URLs is the thing I've been working on, well, in my free time, basically the last month or two. Because there's quite a few problems. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about the terminology. Like, people always call these things in different ways. The bit that comes before the first colon, I'm going to call a scheme. Then the bit that's a domain name, I guess you guys, everyone sort of realizes that. And then the path, then after the path you have the query, and then you get the fragment, the last bit. There's a whole lot of different terminology. Tantek Chadek actually made this blog post, and yeah, everyone does it slightly differently, and everyone includes different parts of the URL. Like, you can call a scheme, you could call it a protocol as well. The fragment identifier has been called a hash. The query string is called search in JavaScript. Path has been called path name, and there's various lots of things. But URLs are fun. There's actually, like, they're quite complex to comprehend, and I had a lot of fun figuring it out. But before we dive into that, let's talk briefly about bytes and code points, which is the thing I researched in the first half of this year. And the thing is, bytes and code points, they're important for URLs, and we'll get to that later. This is the basic concept. Like, this is what I personally had. Like, I couldn't really comprehend that when you have, like, characters on the screen, there's actually, like, an underlying representation of that on the disk, and you get exposed to it in various ways. Like, the moment you submit data to the server, or you're working with strings in JavaScript, which are not quite code points, as Matthias explained. They're actually code units, so you need to do some extra work to actually work with code points. And then there is all the encoding mess and transcoding things. And so I researched that subject, and I wrote this this document called the encoding standard, and it's hosted on the WattBG site at the URL you can see above. Well, let's dismiss this thing. I'm not sure. And it basically explains, like, there's a whole ton of legacy encodings, and they're all quite complex, and how to go from one of those encodings to Unicode and back. And these are the things that browsers do. And it's one of the main themes of my talk, is that it's important to sort of understand, like, one level of extraction lower than what you're working with. So if you work a lot with HTML and writing it out, it's important to have some understanding of bytes and code and how you get to the HTML as well. Because if you understand that, then it's much easier to spot bugs and as you encounter them. You have sort of a fuller understanding of what's actually going on in the browser and with your product. So let's not go into this in too much detail. There's actually the most interesting thing is the indexes. So in the Asian part of the world, they had all these legacy encodings, and since they have so much more characters than us, they couldn't fit them all in single byte encodings. Like here in Europe, we usually have single byte encodings, and like the first 128 bytes were mapped to ASCII, and then the remainder was used, and that depends on the country. Like in Russia, it was usually filled with Cyrillic, and here in the Netherlands, we would have accented characters, and Greece would also have its own Cyrillic variant, etc. But there, they had they had their own encodings, multi-byte encodings, and when they designed Unicode, they didn't actually map them straight. So you need to have these huge mapping tables. Let's see if we can load a small one. I think this one is not too big. That actually works, the network. That's quite nice. So you have these things, like you have all these indexes which you get from when you decode. You go from a couple of bytes and you get an index via some calculation, which is the traditional index in that encoding, and then it maps to a character. Is it just me, or is it not I guess it's just me, because I'm standing closely. It doesn't look that sharp. But so you have these huge ass maps, and browsers have all these things built in. So there's quite a bit of complexity there already. So back to URLs. Here's a simple example of a URL. And if we inspect it, the first one you get, you get the Euro characters you get back. Because what happens is that once the parser hits it, it replaces those things and puts it in the DOM. It's pretty clear. But then if you take a look at the href IDL attribute, you actually get the resolved path. And as you can see, a lot of things have been going on there. The URL parser has been going over what you actually put in and transcoded those characters. And you just look at the first bit. It's basically 3 bytes. And it's the UTF-8 representation of the Euro character, those 3 bytes. And that's because URLs, they work with UTF-8 as their representation for characters that are, outside of ASCII. And so you get these kind of things you get a lot. Like, once you search outside of ASCII on wherever, you typically get these results. Except it's not quite that simple, of course. I mean, it is. You can get weirder things like this. So what happened here is that. So the path is always UTF-8, but the query string depends, and that's because of a lot of legacy there was. Like, we didn't always have the UTF-8 convention for URLs. And form submission and things also went through URLs. So once URLs sort of came to the point that we had to standardize on these characters outside of ASCII, there was already a lot of legacy that was using the local encoding of the server that was serving the document. And so if you submitted forms, it had to be encoded in that encoding. And this is like in Windows 1252, which you might also know as a Latin 1 or ISO 88591. And it actually encodes the Euro sign as a byte 80. And so it's best, like, as a front-end developer, to always do your stuff in UTF-8. You won't hit any of these problems. Always send UTF-8 over the wire, always declare it in your document, and then you never get stuff like this, where you have sort of mismatches going on and the server sort of has no clue what's going on. And especially if you have stuff like this, if your document is, if you have like an API endpoint on the server and you want to talk to it from another domain, and you can do that these days with cores and stuff, and your site is encoded in Windows 1252, and you try to talk to this endpoint, it will get the wrong results. Except, of course, that's not always the case. It's more complicated. It depends on the context. So in some contexts, like form submission, URLs generated from form submission, URLs in the A element, and most HTML elements, I think, like image, script, they all follow the same pattern. There you will get the query component will be encoded according to the document encoding, which should be UTF-8, but isn't always. But it actually depends, like in different contexts, UTF-8 is actually forced. So if you use XML HTTP request, your URLs will always be treated as if they were UTF-8. And the same goes for CSS and things like that. So, yeah, they're a special kind of fun. And the reason I've been researching URLs, I guess I should maybe explain that a little bit, is that there are standards for them, of course. There's you have the RFCs for URI and IRI, which is a crappy term. So wanted to improve the term. But they actually don't define things like if you have a space in your URL, like if you have ahref and you put hello world there, there is a space there, it will work everywhere. The browser will parse it and it will replace that space with person 20. And that will go to the server. But those things are not defined. So every browser sort of guesses and has different results. Like if you, and also, and the other thing is the interaction with the JavaScript API for URLs. Like on an A element, you can get to the protocol, you can set the hash, you can query, you can set the query parameter. And those things are also like very ill-defined, and they differ greatly between different browser vendors. And that's because there's not a single definition for them. And so everyone is unclear and unsure what to do. So that's why I decided to try to fix that problem once and for all and make sure that URLs work properly and that they work the same in all browsers, because it's kind of like a fundamental piece of infrastructure, and that like 20 years after their inception, we still don't quite know how they work. It's kind of a, I think it's a sad thing, but it's also, it's a fun challenge to make it work, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So this is another sidetrack again. I have a few different things. I want to talk a little bit about copyright, because I kind of figured out earlier, like after I left Opera, I felt quite strongly about it. What is this? Not now. So I'm not a lawyer, and it's not legal advice or anything. I was asked to join the W3C again as an invited expert, and I read the document through, and the thing that sort of stung me was that while the W3C documents have a fairly permissive license, you cannot actually reuse their text in like open source software completely. And you cannot fork their documents to write other specifications of, which is exactly, I think, what is important for the web. That the web is for the whole world, and its documentation should be too. And people should be able to take a specification and rewrite it or improve it and fix it. And if their version is the one that ends up mattering, the one that implementers and people start listening to, then that is the one that should be then it proves itself, right? And it shouldn't be proven by the fact that it is tied to some kind of organization that has restrictions on it. I don't think that is the way it should go. And actually, like a lot of the work I've done on the DOM and XML HTTP request, it's all based on prior art, and it's just like researching the subject and improving what already exists, like URLs. I didn't make them up. I'm just trying to fix their documentation. And I think therefore I feel pretty strongly that standard should be in the public domain and easily forkable. And we actually on the WattWG we put most of our stuff on GitHub now, so people can actually go there github.com/WattWG, and you can fork the specifications, you can write new text and do pull requests, the whole thing. So I declined for now. I'm gonna talk with the W3C about this. They have a thing coming up later this month. But for now, I decided to not join as an invited expert and instead do my work at the WattWG and publish in the public domain. Because I think, yeah, these are the standards for the internet and that they should be free and they should be, yeah, like the internet itself. They should be forkable and everyone should be able to influence them. And, yeah. Thanks. Right, I care about forking. All right. Well, that was my little sidetrack there on copyright. We can go back to the complexity stuff now. And actually, I wanted to do the complexity talk. I wanted to do about something simple, you know, because otherwise it gets too complex. So this is a little web page. It has a title and an image, a picture I took. I'm quite proud of this picture. I think it's quite nice. It's somewhere in Greenland, near a small island called Umanak. I recommend visiting it. There's like 1,200 people live there. You get there by helicopter after a couple of planes. And it's really beautiful. And you can take this boat tour at the local hotel, where I don't recommend staying. I recommend taking a tent and camping somewhere because it's like way cheaper. You can camp for free. The hotel is like 150 euros a night. But the boat tour is really cool. They take you along all these huge-ass icebergs. Like, these are way, way tall. You see, there's a little... I have this thing now from Kuhn. Let me try this. Yeah, over there, that's a bird. And these things are like 10 meters high or so. I have another picture somewhere, and you can like go with the boat underneath. And we had a pretty big boat. Anyway, Iceland is cool. Yeah, and Greenland is too. So let's see. I hope the next slide. Yeah, it's simple. And there's a lot of layers. So this is the document. As Matthias explained to you, and let me just demonstrate that as well, since we're here. If you have like a simple DOM like this, you know, so you have the markup to test at the top, and then there's the DOM view there, and the render view underneath. This is called the live DOM viewer. Matthias probably has a short URL for it. But you can also Google it, or you can try to read that. Oh, you can't read the thing at the top because it is some kind of obscured stuff. Anyway, what happens here is that the browser just parses this. And so it's already converted to characters here. Like the input here is characters, not bytes. And then it gets a doc type. It turns it into a token. And the token gets handed off to the parser. And then the parser does the rest of the work. The parser builds up a tree. So here it sees the doc type. All right, we'll add a doc type to the tree. And then it sees an image element, and it's like, oh, whoa, what's going on? That's too soon. So it starts popping these other elements in. It's like, oh, we first need to create an HTML element. So that's what the HTML stage does. And then the HTML stage says, OK, we're done. And then it gets kicked off to the head insertion phase, which is like, hey, that's an image element. We can't do anything with that, but let's insert a head element. And then it gets kicked on, body. Body says, well, hey, there's no body yet. Let's insert a body. And then you get to the image thing, and it inserts the image, and it renders. So this is not actually valid because you need a title, as Matthias explained, but doesn't really matter. I mean, it works. Oh, and it also needs an alt attribute. I'm sorry to all the blind people and Google. But so that's basically what happens in the HTML parser. And so you get this DOM, and therefore, what I showed here works fine. And what I wanted to talk about was to talk about the layers. Like, browser is very complex software, and I sort of wanted to illustrate that a little bit, but just going through just talking a little bit about all these things. Do people want to guess like how many layers there are? Like, who thinks it's more than 10? Who thinks it's more than 20, 30, 40? All right, I don't really know, to be honest. There's a lot of code. Browsers are pretty complex software. Someone yesterday said that Photoshop was pretty complex. I think browsers are more complex. Browsers, you need like a engineering team, at least 200 people or so. And then there's like a bunch of code attached to it that's open source. And all these people are freaking smart too. Like it's a whole lot of work to make a browser and to keep it competitive as well. Like in 2004, we didn't have the JavaScript engine, and now you need to have a JavaScript team of at least like 5 people that know how JIT and all those things and implement that. And it gets hard. And for simplicity, we'll forget about the network for now. There's a lot of stuff there, of course, and it's nice, but let's just talk about the rendering. I wanted to skip rendering too, because it's kind of complicated, but I have to talk about something. All right, so if we start at the top, if you see the page, I guess we don't have to see it. You remember it, right? There was a heading and an image. It's pretty simple. So if you go backwards in the process, the last thing that happened, or the first, if you, depending on how you count, is the painting. So you have some kind of input, and it gets painted, and you see it on the screen. That's simple enough. But it's not exactly that simple, because there's hardware acceleration and all these other things. But then before that, you have the layout tree. That's the kind of thing that was painted. And what's important to understand is that the layout tree is not equal to the DOM tree. It's a separate thing that was created. Let me just check. Yeah. The DOM. Yeah. CSS and the DOM created the layout tree. And the CSVX, they confusedly talk about markup all the time, but the DOM is what matters. That is what being styled. And if you update the DOM, the page it's reflected in the page. And there's like a, let me see, the layout, yeah. And the thing is, like, if you have like a display none on that element, it doesn't end up in the layout tree, and otherwise it would. And there's also like the layout tree is basically, it's kind of like the DOM tree, and it consists of a lot of boxes, but it's also kind of not. Like, you can have, if you have just a single inline element that wraps, in the layout tree, you'll end up with several inline boxes for each line. And yeah, you get the idea. And right. Yeah, I wanted to point this out. The layout tree is not quite like the CSS object model. The CSS object model is what actually happens. Like, once the browser fetches the style sheet and creates and parses it, it goes through this process where you basically get like the CSS model. You get a representation of the style sheet, and that is what the CSS object model is. And that is, it's quite similar to the DOM, which is a representation of the markup. But the layout tree is separate, and it's not actually scriptable in any instance. You can query it in various ways. As Peter Paul showed yesterday, you can query it using offset width and offset height, and you can do that on the elements as well. But the interaction between that and CSS is kind of sketchy, and part of that is because the offset stuff came from the DHTML era, and it never reconciled with the CSS work very well. So the kind of work that happens in CSS and the kind of work that happens on like exposing what happens in CSS, it's not really, there's not a lot of work going on in that area, actually. I think it's improving now in the CSS working group, and I believe Google is investing effort in that area. But there's actually, like, the layout tree is sort of an unknown thing. Well, it's actually quite important, because that's what we end up seeing. And I'm not sure why I put this away. Yeah. So once the browser has built this style sheet and it has all these rules in it, and then the rules are matched to the nodes in the DOM using selectors, and all these little things, they seem very simple, but they're not. Like selectors themselves are already quite complex. I don't know. How many people think that? Do people know how selectors work? Could people raise their hands if they? All right. So quite a few people know how selectors work. I'll But quite a few didn't either, or at least didn't raise their hand. So briefly, what happens is that the browser goes through the DOM tree, and for each node it sees, it goes through all the selectors in the style sheet and checks whether it matches or not. So to make this a bit more obvious, let's look at the example here. And make a selector. All right. So we have a style sheet. We have one selector. How many nodes are matched? Or how many nodes does it traverse through? Let's do that. It goes actually through five. So first it checks whether it matches the HTML element. Doesn't head, doesn't style, doesn't body, doesn't image, does. So you get a match. Of course, there's optimizations here. Like browsers have hash tables for tag names and those things. But effectively, it would go through all of those and check whether it matches or not. There's not really many other ways you can do it. So we add one, like, let's add more borders. Now it goes through all these elements and checks whether they match or not. And there could be a second body element. Like, so it doesn't quite know whether that's the first. Like, if we insert another body element, it will still have to work. Like, we can do... maybe we should give a different style, because otherwise I guess you can't see it. We can do something like this. Oh, there you go. There it is. So you can actually you can do all kinds of weird stuff with the DOM. You can't do this in HTML. There was a question about that yesterday. Like, what happens if you omit the end tags? Is that faster or not? And it does indeed not matter much. I think it's actually quite a little bit faster because it ends up being ignored. Like, if I add this body here and then add this text test, you see that it still ends up in the document. So the body end tag is kind of useless. It doesn't do anything. Like, if you, the moment you insert text, it just gets there. But anyway, now we've got a quite complex document, and the selectors start multiplying. So we now have, we have seven elements. Two selectors, or three selectors, so you get 21 matches. Now, this is fairly simple, but once you start like Gmail-like applications with thousands and thousands of DOM nodes, and thousands of selectors, like there's really big style sheets, and I guess you guys all know this thing, like you do the same kind of thing. It gets really, really hard to stay performant, and that is the kind of reason why, how many people heard of matches? It's like a promise pseudo class to select parents. So you can select the parent nodes and you can make decisions based on what parent it is, how you want to style the child. So you would have something like, I want to style this image element, but only if it has a P as a parent. And that can let you do really powerful stuff, and you can select elements, and you don't have to add all these classes and stuff, and it makes it a little bit simpler. But it makes it a lot harder for the browser to stay performant and do all these computations effectively and quickly. The other thing is, like, once you get to... And the main thing that's hard with the browser is because it's dynamic. So each time you might make changes to the DOM and through the parsing stage, everything needs to be updated, and all the selectors need to be recomputed. So if you have your DOM with 10,000 nodes and your 10,000 selectors, and you start updating things and the user starts hovering around with the mouse and interacting, all these things start spinning, and you get a lot of work, and you understand why something quite simple is actually very complex, because all these processes are going on. Yeah. Well, let me just get some water. I'm not sure whose this is. So CSS syntax is kind of cool. I think Matt has actually showed this already, so you can. It's you can escape anything, like in the selector, in the property names. You can use all kinds of weird escapes. Nobody does it, and I don't really understand why it was added. I think it was partially because CSS was grammar based. So you get all this weird stuff. That the background line, you can write it like this, and you can write it in a lot of different ways, which actually makes, like, if you want to do like a CSS-based filtering, you really have to do like whitelist things, because otherwise you're going to be in trouble. Yeah, it's kind of weird. Yeah, and even this is like. It's a tremendous simplification because there's so many things going on in CSS. Like, I guess many of you have seen the standard. It's like a whole lot of pages. You have to deal with inheritance, initial values, specificity, complex syntax. So if you go through, there's like a whole lot of different pieces of code involved in doing all that work. And there's like the layout team, just like 10 people working on that thing and optimizing it and making sure that it works fast. And this for each browser, of course. And you can have external style sheets. There's multiple style sheets, and there's interaction with scripts. And all that works together and tries to render this page to make this really simple thing possible for us. I think that's really, it's quite cool. And right, so we covered the layout part a little bit. There's a DOM as well. And everyone knows about the DOM, of course. It's nobody really likes it. But it is a core part of the web infrastructure. It's the API against which script, against which layout happens. And it's basically what the web page is. It's where the semantics are at. Because the DOM is what everyone reads of, like the assistive technology. It's what's being updated by scripts and. So the semantics are actually at the DOM. They're not really at the markup level. And that's why the whole discussion about like HTML versus XML like years ago was not very interesting. In the end, what you get is a DOM. And that's what's important. And everyone builds up some kind of representation of the markup. The markup is just like a convenient syntax to create it. But you can also create a DOM for script or something. And And then the DOM itself, it's designed somewhat clunky. It was designed a long time ago, back when there was still this value of JavaScript was not the only language. We had to make this thing work for multiple languages. It had to work for server and client. And so they designed this really weird thing around the oh my god IDL. It's not actually oh my god, but it's OMG IDL. It's a kind of syntax to define all these interfaces. And they also designed the DOM not just for like doing scripts and stuff, but also for editing applications. So they preserved things in the DOM like comments, processing instructions you can find in the DOM. The doc type is there. There's not really any reason for a doc type to be in the DOM. I mean, it's just like it's a synthetic detail. But yet it is there, so you need to skip it if you traverse the document tree, which is kind of annoying. And then they had this thing where attributes were nodes. We're actually trying to fix that. So the new DOM standard makes attributes no longer inherit from node. We're not quite sure if it's going to work out or if it breaks the web. The Mozilla guys are brave enough to pioneer this for us and test it out in Firefox, slowly deprecating the methods over time. If you use like get attribute node, you'll see warnings in Firefox, which is, I think, is quite awesome. Hopefully the other browsers move in that direction too. Because, the main reason is it's already complex enough. Like if we can remove some of the complexity and all that it takes, we can focus that on other efforts and improve other areas of the web. And yeah, keep the web. Yeah, so that's another thing. What's really important is that by keeping it simple or simple enough, we at least make it possible for other players to enter the market. And that's in part why I'm writing standards and I'm trying to write them in such a level of detail that anyone can implement them and will work the same way as, say, as Chrome or Opera. Because otherwise the web will end up as a locked up space like it was a couple of years ago, or not too long ago, when IE6 was still dominating. Like the other browsers had to actively reverse engineer IE6 behavior. And of course they did it wrong and didn't know quite what to do. But if they didn't, they couldn't compete with IE effectively because a lot of sites would not work. And it's really important to keep the web an open marketplace. And I'm a little bit afraid of the whole WebKit dominance thing as well. Because what you get is that WebKit gets really big, people start coding towards WebKit, people start coding towards WebKit bugs, and WebKit bugs get enshrined in the platform. And also, I think the WebKit people at Google and stuff, they agree, it's also a problem for the WebKit project itself, because if people start relying on their bugs, they cannot fix them. And so you end up with all these extra holes and problems in the platform. And that's why it's really important that we have solid standards and tests and to keep the web relatively open and progressing. And the DOM itself, so to get back on that, it's quite a complex thing. There's many, many objects. Like just for HTML, there's about 100 different interfaces. And all these interfaces, all these objects, they have a lot of attributes, and these attributes have their own algorithms to set and read. How many people have actually looked at the HTML spec, like and read like an interface definition, for instance? How many people understand WebIDL? One hand goes up. Wow. So I agree with Alex Russell. I think he doesn't like WebIDL. And let me just load the HTML spec. And WebIDL is it's indeed. So here's a piece. The thing is, so we had OMG IDL, which was like heavily generic, and both for Java, JavaScript, C, and what you name it. It was generic and ugly. And WebIDL is sort of it's a refinement, but more tuned towards JavaScript. But it still has the kind of ugly syntax tied to it that people don't really like, and they think we should redefine and instead use JavaScript directly in some way. And I'm okay with that. I don't really care what language you use. I just want it to be well-defined. And WebIDL happens to be the current best thing that actually defines how you need to implement all these objects. So here we have the image element. And let me just explain how to read this, because I think it's useful to know. Because then you can actually, like, if you're dealing with some script and you're sort of wondering what can I do with this script, you can actually look up what you can do. Like image element, you have the named constructors. That's a legacy thing, actually. So you can say new image, right, in JavaScript. And some of you might recall this from the old days, but it's still fine way to create an HTML image element. So instead of document.create element, you do new image, and you get an image back. And you can even pass it parameters. Like you can pass width and height, which both need to be numbers. And Well, you can guess what they do. They set the width and height. It's not that hard. Then once you have the image element, you can set. These attributes are the ones you can set. And this is actually different. There's a difference between setting, or these are the properties you can set, I guess, in JavaScript. You would say properties. And that's kind of the confusing mismatch here. IDL talks about attributes. JavaScript talks about properties. So these are the properties that the image element has. You have alt, search, search head. There's a new one, cross origin, for doing course support. There's use map, there's is map. And you can read out the natural width, which is the original, the intrinsic width of the image. It's not actually the rendered. I have 5 minutes left. Oh, geez, that goes quick. I thought I had 50 minutes.
Then take 50 minutes.
Okay. Oh, yeah, we can do Q&A. Okay. I'll try to. And there's complete, which tells you whether the image was successfully rendered or not. I guess the main thing I'm saying, it's not quite that hard to read. Like, you have this thing, and it describes an object you have in JavaScript. So you can just see the properties, and then you can play around with them and figure out how it works. And it's kind of daunting at first. And for me, it was daunting at first to learn about these things, and how do I get a hold of this object? But as you read more, it got more understandable. And maybe, actually, if Alex goes through, we can make it even better and do it in a slightly different way. So let's see. I have a few slides left, I think. Yeah. This I already explained. Like, the DOM, you create it from a large string and from markup, and it's code points, which were transferred as bytes originally, and that's how you end up with the DOM. There's many, many layers. And these were not all of them. Like, yeah. It's hard to make a coherent picture of that, I think. Or, yeah, as you've seen. But here's a few of them. You have the network, you have the input to the parser itself, the DOM, the scripts, the style, layout, the tree, the painting. And then all these concepts have like a whole lot of different code paths and complexity tied to it. And I guess what it comes down to is this is why we have bugs, you know? All these systems, they're created by people. Including the standards and the software, and they're not quite perfect. So there's bugs everywhere. But knowing a little bit about how these things fit together, you can sort of realize where the bugs are and make a more coherent bug report, maybe. And it's not all bad. There's a lot of progress as well. But by figuring out all these old stuff like the HTML parser. HTML was like invented in, what was it, 94? And up until 2011, we haven't had like interoperable HTML parser implementations. All the browsers sort of did their own thing. And now they are finally like interoperable. And this was based on work from Ian Hickson, who started in 2006, started figuring out HTML, and wrote down the parser algorithm and got all the vendors on board to implement it. And this helps browsers as well, of course. I mean, it gets their code base becomes more maintainable, and we can now make and the upside is that we can now make changes to HTML parser and like add new features without introducing all kinds of problems. So, and this is sort of why I'm doing the work on encodings and URLs, but by fixing all the groundwork, we can slowly move ahead and with less problems in the future. So I'm doing on time, Chris told me. I was actually, before you do applause, I wanted to just raise one thing. What I think is, we had the jam sessions, and I thought that was really cool with the 10 minutes things, and I was kind of wondering like how people feel about doing that same kind of thing for a full conference. Because there's so many of you here, and you have obviously way more interesting things to talk about than I do. Like, I was just invited here because I worked on standards for 7 years. But it would be way cooler to have like everyone here just give a 5 or 10 minute pitch on whatever is their passion. And I was sort of just throwing it out there, and I'll read on Twitter or something what people think about that idea. Like, to just, instead of having just 10 people share their thing for 2 days, have 400 people, or maybe a little bit less, share their passion. and then have some kind of collaboration thing going on.
Hi. These things happen. We call them bar cams.
Yeah, I guess, I was thinking it would probably be bar camps. Yeah,
so they totally are happy to, and you can organize them. I did three of them, and they're really easy to organize rather than these big ones here that cost a lot of money and places, and people want food, and it's really annoying.
The thing with bar camps, though, is that there's a lot of different rooms, usually, and a lot of tracks, whereas it would be nice to just have, like, give everyone, like, an audience of 400, you know?
It scares a lot of people as well.
I guess, yeah.
So, that was a lot of words, and kitten pictures, I think, as well. And I have this wonderful question here, like, please explain the charmod CO73 warning when I get when I use a HTTPH, href, and a Unicode character in a data attribute and an A tag.
Wait, I have to read that again.
Yeah, please don't.
Oh, okay.
a few that actually have more interesting meaning, like, query selector all, does it use the same matching algorithm as internal browser methods, and is it very fast because of that?
Query selector all, yeah, it does use, it uses the same algorithm as the CSS parser does. And I would assume it's faster, yeah. It uses the same optimized code paths. Like, selectors are a very complex piece of code, actually, in browsers these days. They're extremely optimized because layout itself, because it's so complex, because CSS is at such a high level of abstraction, there's a lot of time dedicated to it because it's sort of like there was a lot of focus on JavaScript performance, but there's not really much focus on CSS performance. Well, and there's more these days, but I think that's really what's holding web applications back a little bit. Is like really good layout performance. Like, we had JavaScript performance go 10 times. Or 100 times faster since we started out, but we haven't had the thing like a tenfold increase in CSS performance. I mean, that kind of thing would be awesome to have.
Well, we also made CSS much more complex. Now we have animations and transitions and shaders and effects.
Exactly. Yeah. We keep adding this stuff while we don't actually understand what we have so far. But I mean, that is.
Good one here. If you could replace the DOM with something better, what would it look like, and what would be the biggest things of the DOM that are actually need replacing? Is it something like the jQuery selector engine, or?
I guess we would have a better API, and I would drop a lot of the redundant stuff. Like, the DOM has a lot of methods that we don't really need. There's a lot of interfaces we don't really need. We don't need document type. We don't need attributes to be nodes. Actually, attributes could just be strings on the element object, I think. But we have to keep them as objects to make dot attributes work, unfortunately. I would remove comment. I wouldn't keep that in the tree. That's not needed in a tree. So I would just, and maybe you could even drop the document node itself. You would just have element to start. You make it much more like the APIs you have in Python, like E3 or whatever it's called. Mm.
But one thing about this that ails me a lot, being somebody who came to the web in 1996 because of passion, coming from another media, radio, to the web, I look at HTML and it was simple rules and it was wonderful and easy to understand what I do with this. I mark up text with a few commands.
Yeah.
And I start with a P and I end with a P and I know it's a paragraph.
Right.
That a rendering engine doesn't need this doesn't mean that we should bastardize HTML that way, I think.
Oh, no, I was trying to explain, like, how the parser works. I think, like, if you work in a team, you should probably always use quotes, and closing your tags makes sense unless you have, like, a common understanding in the team that everyone knows what they're doing. Like, I personally don't bother usually closing LI because, I mean, LIs are only going to be in an OL anyway, so it's not much point in closing them.
Or UL.
Yeah, are they going to be? Yeah, but I mean, they're always going to be in a container.
But and they have a different meaning. One of them has an order of the lists and a defined one. The other one could be in any order. So that's what I'm saying. Like, it's great that these things are random.
No, but what I meant, there's always going to be allies. They're always going to be siblings. I guess that's what I meant. So you don't really need to close them because you know. Yeah, but
it's the same with the DOM. I mean,
but I'm fine with people closing all their tags and like, it's probably better and it's more like. it's more approachable, and yeah, it makes it easier to understand. But I think it's also good to have an understanding of what's actually going on. Like, if you trip up, that you sort of realize, like, oh, okay, I forgot this closing tag, and therefore this thing happened.
But yeah. On the most display glitches, when you build websites, just because you forgot something and browsers inject something you didn't even know existed.
Hmm.
So the predictability of an error is always, for me, a confusing point. Like, that's why I like the idea of XHTML.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not popular, but I like code breaking when I make mistakes,
yeah,
rather than browsers doing things to fix it for me.
Now, that is great. The thing is, like, with XHTML in particular, like, if you start using that in a production website and you don't use, like, a lot of people, we use string concatenation to make our websites. We don't have, like, a DOM on the server, and we serialize that and make sure it's well-formed. So then you have your typical web shop where you sell games, and you search for black and white, which has an ampersand, and the guys that made the web shop, they used XHTML but didn't quite realize what they're doing, so they didn't escape the ampersand. So I opened it up in Opera, and I got the well-formedness error and couldn't order my game. And this actually happened, like, back in 2000.
Well, it's much like when people forget a semicolon in their PHP and the PHP doesn't render. This is what code is like.
Sure.
Forgivable code is very dangerous for people to teach things.
Yeah, but PHP, it runs on one product, whereas your website runs in, like, millions of people, their browsers. And it's sort of, like, out of your control what's going to happen. So it's better to use a forgiving format than to throw these errors at users. Because your PHP is what you control. But the moment you start serving a website, you include content from third parties, just, like, there's going to be unknown variables in that. And unless you have a perfectly airtight system, which is really hard to write, like, it's really complex to make sure that all the XHTML and all the your output is always going to be that case. Because then you need to really, really test your backend system. Like, I mean, I can understand that for a slide set or a simple HTML page, you could just use XHTML because it's going to be static. But the moment you get, like, the dynamic things going on and you get all these input from sources, you need to have a whole XML toolchain on your server that does all these things. And that, I mean, no disrespect, but it's a complex thing. Even for, like, there's a few people that tried, like Sam Ruby tried this on his blog and tried to write this perfect block system, and there's still people every now and then who found cracks in it and made it give well-formedness errors to users. And giving errors to users is, like, a big no-no, I think.
Yeah, it is, but at the same time, allowing anybody to write any code is a big no-no as well, because we don't evolve as a craft.
Well, we don't allow it, right? That's why we say, like, use validation and understand if you get errors, understand what happened and fix those. Like, I think that's our thing. Like, we have validators and there's checkers and I think most people here, they care, right? We care about that kind of stuff. We wanna fix the validation errors and we wanna understand what the fuck we're doing.
So it's more
and I mean, there's some people that don't really care and they just wanna put out content. And I think that's cool too. I mean, it's really important to put out content. That's the whole thing the web is about, to share your stuff. And if you don't really know HTML that well, you made an error. I mean, it's better that you can share your content than you get an error or something, I think.
So it's more about tooling, that the tools actually allow you to create clean things without having to think about it.
Yeah, I guess in part it might be about tooling. It depends on where you're from, I guess. Like, if you don't really have a strong background in HTML, and then you might want to use a tool. If you have a strong background in HTML, you might want to do it yourself. And even if you don't have a strong background, you might just want to play around with HTML and see, I don't know, yeah. Hmm. There's not really any point I'm trying to make here. I'm just saying, like, yeah.
What's your thoughts on the Shadow DOM proposal stuff? Like web components, XTAC, these kind of things, making the browser markup more extensible in the browser with JavaScript.
Yeah, I'm getting around to the idea. I still find it kind of scary to release the semantics to the crowd, I guess. But it might be a good idea. And it's not like opening the floodgates or anything, because as Alex has said, we people are already doing this, right?
Mm.
People already create their own elements. So might as well give them a way to do it properly. And I think the Shadow DOM itself, plus web components, is a really interesting way. Like, I embedded a Google Maps like a couple of months ago. I was playing around with the Google Maps API, and I had this simple page set up with a div, and I gave it, had to, given the div some styling, and I don't really use IDs for div usually. I just do div and then give it a width, and gave it a red background. And this Google Map thing wasn't working, and I didn't understand why. Until after all, I realized that Google Map, like, that inserted the API, inserted a whole bunch of divs in my page, and I was tiling those divs, and therefore nothing was happening. And that's like, that's very annoying. That was very annoying because I couldn't use generic styles because I was clashing with this Google Map thing. I mean, that was really weird. So, and with components, that Google Map thing becomes its own separate component, and your styles will not affect it unless you want to. Like, there is some kind of like bridging thing there. And I think that makes that kind of thing, like where you have like a lot of different components and different people make those, or you want to embed a map on your page and you don't want to mess around with the styling in your own, it makes it a lot easier to I guess, work together and do things. And also like for UI stuff, like making new buttons and all those things. And like if you want to make a button that consists of like 10 divs, I mean, go ahead and then you just hide it from the DOM and like the DOM stays semantic. I think that's the other nice thing. Like the DOM is sort of clean, and in the background you have all these different elements to do your tricks. Yep. You sort of hide them from the people that script and try to get content out of your page.
Good. Lunch.
Lunch.
Thanks, Anne.
All right.
See you back here in an